serve any questions.
Yeah. What is the difference between formless meditation and what we're practicing now?
This is formless.
Okay, good.
It's the other way round. Everything else has got form. And this has no form. This is formless means that there's no concepts and images, and it's just your own natural state before it takes form. So we let the form go and not get caught up by the form and the forms.
Is that like Rigpa?
Yes, but I don't know about Tibetan Buddhism. So. Personally, I don't. I guess because I come from such a dry background. I was brought up with Zen, and that's about as minimal as it gets, really. At least the form that I practice. So it was never anything that was encouraged. But if you find that it helps, I was saying yesterday how it, to nurture that relationship with the real me, as it were, that which is beyond me. If you find that's a skillful way, a useful way, and it works for you, then prayer, that's a part of your communication, isn't it? It's a way of creating that heartfelt connection. And if it works for you, I don't see anything wrong with it at all, as long as you don't misunderstand it. And you start praying to something out there, which a lot of people do in the world. But as Buddhists, we have to be careful about doing that. I mean, it's not something I've done, but I think provisionally that can even be done in Buddhism, but it has to be brought back. So we really begin to wean ourselves off this dualism that actually is at the basis of all of our difficulties anyway. And we don't want to start compounding it. Even though what we may be praying to may be something good, but it's still an object, and it's a trap that we can so easily fall into over and over, because that's what we are. We're just a bundle of objects. We just create objects, and we are objects. and it's the whole purpose of Dharma ultimately is to come back into our original state, to lose all of that. Those objects, that duality that we created, to let all that go and rediscover our eternal nature, that spaciousness that doesn't have objects, that isn't an object, that's beyond space and time and is eternal. And the more that we involve ourselves with objects and get caught up with objects, however wonderful they may be, they are still nevertheless objects. And we just got to be so careful, because that is always our inclination to fall into that. And I guess in many ways the most dangerous objects are spiritual objects, because we think they're wisdom, they're great, they're the source of release, they are release. And so we can get attached to those and talk ourselves out of the unskillful objects that we got in our life. And then fall into the trap of, getting attached to those, what we would consider to be sort of wholesome and skillful objects, which can be very useful, but we must be careful. There is always a danger. That danger is ever present. Whatever we do, the danger, the opposite, is always present. And we need to be on our guard continually. And it's awareness that is the guard. And if we keep returning to our awareness, we will slowly break the habit of falling into that trap. But we need to be careful. But prayer, anything, Dharma is something of the heart. It's the affairs of the heart. The Dharma are the affairs of the heart. It's not the affairs of the head and the mind. It's the affairs of the heart. And the more that we can return to our heart, return to that warmth and that spaciousness, the more skillful it is just to learn to warm ourselves up. And if prayer can be something that can help to warm us up. And it can be, you know, it's been used since the beginning of time, and Buddhism uses it. So, you know, obviously there's a lot of wisdom and there's a lot of skill there. But like I say, I think, you know, that, like everything else, and Buddhism can be very dangerous. I mean, we become very attached to it, and we can end up, you know, becoming a Buddhist rather than becoming a free being. The trap is there. Every moment of the way, the trap is there. Mara's waiting to gobble us up at every moment. And its most productive grounds would have to be on the spiritual grounds. Because we do get caught very, very easily, because we assume that because it's wholesome and spiritual, therefore it must be okay. And we buy into it for the wrong reasons. But prayer is not something that, you know, formal prayer, that's probably what you're saying, it's not something I've ever done myself, but if it's something that's helpful, it doesn't make you all soppy and sloppy, then by all means.
Is that devotional prayers?
Yeah. I mean, that's the danger with that. We can end up being very sloppy and also, you know, airy-fairy about it. Whereas using all of that as a skillful dharmic tool, as a source of wisdom, and engage with the heart, because devotional stuff, especially devotional, is nothing but the heart. This is not a formula like we do when we sit and meditate a lot of the time. This is very much a heartfelt exercise, as it were, which is something that, you know, I'm sure most of us can actually make use of, us Western people. But like I say, just be very careful. If it suits you, it doesn't suit everybody, it doesn't suit me, I'm not that way inclined, but for other people, it can be a very useful tool. You don't go looking for anything, and especially you don't go looking for other forms. Oh, that was interesting. That was. Maybe something, you know, a part of you that, something that you've been carrying, something that, you know, you identify quite close with, and it's maybe something a bit negative, and it comes up and you feel like, oh, I've got something to understand here, something to work with, and then maybe if you do deal with it in a skillful way, it will drop off. And then you think to yourself, oh, well, that was good, I'll go and see if I can find another bit now. And then you start go raking around inside your mind to find another little hang-up that you've got that you want to bring to the surface and have a good old poke around with, because, like, you know, you want to be free and enlightened and stuff, so therefore let's get in there and, you know, that is very, very suspect, and do your best not to fall into that trap, because, you know, who's doing the looking? Who wants to sort things out? It's our little friend again, isn't it? Who wants to be the wise one, and who wants to liberate you from your attachment? It's that sense of self again. And the way, I'm sure we've all discovered this, the way life is, actually, we don't have to go looking for trouble, do we? However settled and peaceful we are, and we can experience, you know, stretches of real calm where everything seems to fall away. So sooner or later something will come up. Just be patient. Sorry? That's there is nothing more. The whole of all of the whole of Buddhism, which is a collection of skillful means, are tools of all shapes and sizes, from different cultures, from different perspectives. Just this incredible, incredible, wonderful collection of skillful means. All of them, without exception, are teaching us to let go. That's all they're doing. They're all tools so that we can become unattached, so we can let things rise and pass away. This is not a detachment from life. It's a detachment from getting caught up with ourselves and our stuff. And each one of those skillful means, in whichever perspective, to whatever sort of depth of degree, are all there to nurture our ability to let our experiences go. When they come up, let go, let go. And if we can let go, if we can truly let go, that's it. That's the end of the world. The world is there because we don't let go. The world is there because we buy into it and we feed it. It's the logs we put on the fire, the passions, greed, hatred and delusion. We're forever feeding that fire. And it's just learning not to feed the fire. It's learning to leave the fire alone. It's not saying, now throw some water on the fire, do anything with the fire. It's learning to declutch from that habit that's so deep that we, even when we know it, we still participate of it. We have a fire there and we want it to go out. We can see that it's very destructive. So we look at the fire and we just really wish the fire would go out. And while we're wishing for the fire to go out, we're throwing logs on it. Go out, fire, go out, go out. And you get more and more kindling and wood. Why didn't you go out? Why didn't you go out? You're so, I don't want you anymore. Go out, go out. And all the time. I mean, now, isn't that utterly, utterly insane? Eh? That's exactly what we do. If we spend our whole lives feeding the fire. That's how caught up we are with delusion and ignorance. We're so stupid. Excuse me. I include myself always. We are so stupid that we just continually fuel the fire. The fire that we know is the source of all trouble, is the cause of all my trouble. This is what binds me. This is what keeps me in this state of unsatisfactoriness. And yet the whole time I'm going like this. Now if you see it in those terms, you know, everybody laughs. How stupid. Sorry. This is exactly what we do. And the Dharmic way with that fire. And it's something we have to learn because we just don't know it. The Dharmic way is to leave the fire alone. And leaving the fire alone means not to throw fuel on it. And that is a way of expressing that what we do is that we don't get attached. We're not reacting to that fire. We're no longer being caught up by that fire. We're no longer buying into the whole experience. We're learning just to leave it alone, just to leave it alone. And this is the non-doing. We just leave it alone. And what will happen if I put a fire there in the middle of that floor there, providing the floor wasn't wood, a stone floor, and I put a pile of wood there and I set it on fire and I didn't throw fuel on it, what would happen if I didn't feed it? Well, you know the answer, don't you? Sooner or later it will go out. Actually, that needs to be looked at, because not only does it go out, and this is the really important thing, not only does we fulfill our wish that the thing has actually gone out, but what is crucial, what is absolutely crucial about that event, is that in order for it to go out, or when it goes out, it will have burnt every last bit of that fuel. There will be no more fuel. So when that burns out, when that burns down and the fire goes out, There is no longer any more fuel there that can come into fire. It's gone, and it's gone forever. It is literally gone forever. And this is what the Dharma promises us. If we truly leave things alone, just let them burn themselves out, let that fire burn itself out. When it truly burns itself out, it is literally forever. And that is, to me, that is just tremendous. Because the way that we deal with fires in our life and in the world, and how life, the world, our culture teaches us to deal with fires, is to react to them. Of course, the stupid thing is to put fuel on them, but we may get a bucket of water and throw water on the fire. And hey, look, I've put the fire out. So I've succeeded, haven't I? So what's your problem? The thing is, when that fuel dries out, which it will do sooner or later, it has always got the potential to come back into fire. That's the difference. That's the difference between the worldly way of dealing with a fire, which is to become reactive, and the dharmic way, which is to do nothing and to restrain your habits, to hold back from that compulsion, from that impossible habit that we've got that just intent on expressing itself, which in effect is throwing fuel on the fire, this reacting, to just restrain that. And this is what we do with this practice. And we can only do that with awareness, where we just declutch from the fire, where you just leave the fire alone. You don't react to the fire, but you declutch from it and leave it alone. This is the dharmic way. This is unique. There is nothing in the world that works like this. The world is a system of being reactive. We do not react. We leave it alone. And this is the tremendous profundity of the Dharma, which sets it apart from anything else we'll ever do in our life. Everything we do in our life is a series of actions and reactions that have consequences that go on and on and on and on and on. When we actually just stand still and we let that thing burn itself up, truly burn itself up, so the fuel is completely gone, it is gone forever. And that is just, to me, is just so tremendous. There is nothing in the world that can even begin to compare with that. The world is something that's always as a temporary expedient means. This is permanent. And when I say permanent, I mean it's gone, not for this life, but that volition, that fire that just goes from life to life to life, that life will burn away. It will go. It will be extinguished forever. And that is something that is unique and is just tremendous. But we've got to learn it. We've got to learn not to throw fuel on the fire. And just to put it another way, we just teach, we learn, we cultivate the ability not to be reactive and not to be attached. And that's it. It is nothing but a process of learning to become unattached. And everything in Buddhism, these are skillful means to help us nurture, to learn to put that in place, that what we've never done in our lives, that actually is incredibly difficult, because everything inside of us wants to react and throw fuel on the fire, or throw buckets of water on it. Do something. We've got to do something to make that fire go out. We have to learn this. We have to learn. And we keep falling over and we keep throwing fuel on the fire, and then we learn to pick ourselves up and declutch again, and pick ourselves up and resist that temptation to fall back into that old habit over and over and over again, because we don't know it. We don't know it. If we knew it, we'd do it. We don't know it. We like to think we know, but we've got to put it into practice. We've got to, you know, if you want to know what an ice cream tastes like, you can theorize about it forever. The only way that you're ever going to know what that ice cream really tastes like is when you put it in your mouth. And that's beyond intellectualization, that's beyond theories and ideas and this and this and this. As a direct experience, when you put that ice cream in your mouth, you know what it tastes like. And that's the Dharma. It is something to taste, it's something to do. It's a direct experience, a direct impact. And that direct impact we have got to learn, because we're always wanting to react and to theorize and to fiddle and do things over and over again. And to learn to get familiar with that ability not to throw fuel on the fire. And it really is so simple. And yet everything inside of us says, no, you're not going to do it. And that's the paradox, that's the dilemma, if you like, that in fact it is so simple and yet it's so difficult. But this is what we need to learn to put into practice, to become familiar with. And in time, maybe it does get a bit easier. Who knows?
With regards to what you were saying about, you mentioned about having choice, do you have to, if you're throwing fuel on a fire but you're not aware of it, does your choice only really kick in when you become aware of it?
Absolutely.
So it might be in retrospect, but then you're armed with it next time.
For the next time, yeah. It's a learning process. And without awareness, we can't even begin to go on the spiritual path. Awareness is the key, as I say, it's the jewel in the crown. With that, everything becomes possible. And when we don't have awareness, everything is lost. And it's learning to, like I say, to polish that awareness, to become familiar with the awareness, which is what we do with this sort of practice, where we just simply become alive to ourselves, wake up to ourselves, so that when something happens, you know, we have that moment before we fall into our old habit. If we don't have that spark, that awareness there, we will go straight into our old thing, like an animal does. An animal is its instincts. When a mouse runs across the floor, the cat will chase after the mouse. It doesn't stop and think, I wonder if I should... Is it the right? I don't really fancy white mice so much as I prefer dark ones. And they just do it. And actually, we pretty much chase mice most of the time as well, as it so happens. But the difference between us and the cat is that we can declutch from that. And that declutching becomes possible because of awareness. And in that moment, we can say no. And we can stop ourselves on falling into that habit that turns that wheel of becoming, the paticca sammapada, is spun by craving, and we just hold back. And if we don't give it volition, if we don't give it the energy to turn, it will slow down. And when it slows down, eventually it will stop. But it's always you can never get away from the awareness. It's the awareness. If we don't have it, then it just doesn't begin. It's all up here. You get all the answers up here because you don't really need awareness up here. You just need an ability to read and have an intellect to be able to sift all this stuff. But that doesn't actually do anything for you. In fact, it can often make things a lot worse. It's that awareness which is the jewel that all humans have got, and that's why the Dharma is for everybody. Because it's awareness and not the intellect that's actually the thing that will take us away, take us out of suffering. And it is about, you know, we fall over and you go, oh, I've done that again, I had no awareness, here I go again. But that's okay, you know, this is how it works. But then you have the experience of that and you know, well, look, if I had awareness, I wouldn't have done that. I would have just contained myself. So next time it comes, maybe you lose your awareness again. Oh, damn me, that's twice I've done it. Goodness me, what a silly billy I am. But that's okay, because that's you really begin to see how incredibly caught we are by ourselves. We just, you know, we get this, especially in our culture, I'm free, you see it on all the adverts on television. Be free. You know, eat this or drink this and be free. Freedom. You know, people sell freedom and we all go for it. You call that freedom? That's not freedom, that's just conditioning and that's just being bound and trapped by nonsense. Freedom is when you don't buy the stuff on television. and get that spaciousness in your life when you're no longer attached and caught up and craving and running after and running away. And that's all attachment. And all of that those great ideals can be aspired to in only one way, and that's through awareness. And this is what we need to nurture and polish and bring to our lives. And no matter how much we fall over, to pick ourselves up and to come back and to come back and be kind to ourselves and say, you know, I'm doing my best. You know, this is not easy. You know, I'm bound by lots of stuff and I keep falling over and I keep falling over. But that's okay. The commitment's there, and to pick yourself up and to come back without getting into that negativity and blaming yourself and blaming other people and all the rest of it. Fall over and pick yourself up. Fall over and pick yourself up. That, to me, is the most difficult thing in practice, is to pick yourself up without falling into some reactivity about, here, I failed again. We have to learn this, because when we start to become reactive to our apparent shortcomings, we're actually compounding the very thing that we're meant to be working on. This is how clever and how subtle it is, that we just need to learn to just let go of all of that and fall over and pick ourselves up and fall over and pick ourselves up, and not get into this idea that I have eventually got to stay on my feet and not fall over. Until that day comes when I can actually walk without falling over, I'm not really doing this practice. I've got to walk without falling over, because when I do that, then I'm going to get to the end of the path there, and I'm going to get the pot of gold that I promised myself. That is an absolute total delusion. And if that were true, we would all be complete failures, because nobody does it. Maybe a Buddha. Let's let's give the Buddha the benefit of the doubt. Let's say, you know, that once every so many thousands of years a Buddha comes along, and okay, maybe he can walk without falling over. Okay, that's the exception. But for the rest of us, we fall over, and it doesn't matter who you are, what your insight is. People fall over. And if we think this path, this whole thing that we're doing is about walking without falling over, like I say, we're going to fail. Change doesn't take place in being able to walk from here to the end there without falling over. Believe me, change takes place when you fall over. When you fall over and when you pick yourself up, that whole changing process, providing you're prepared to come back and to dust yourself down and go off again without become reactive towards yourself, without just actually compounding the whole thing. The more that you can just pick yourself up and bring yourself again to the practice, fall over, pick yourself up and bring yourself up, in that place there is where change takes place. It is not in the achieving. That is just such a misunderstanding of what this is about. It is not in the achieving. It is in your willingness. It is in your willingness to come back, in your willingness and your commitment to the practice, to get these disappointments and these difficulties over and over, which we all do. But to metaphorically take a deep breath, put your chest out and come back, and come back, and come back, and come back. And I can absolutely assure you, if that commitment's in place, if it's in place on a level that's not accessible in our subconscious, things are happening, because you're now addressing something that's been in power for forever, literally forever, that you are now saying to yourself, no, the game is up. I'm not going to play this game anymore. I'm going to just bring myself back over and over, and I'm not going to give up. You're not going to overpower me and knock me. I'm just going to come back, and I'm going to come back. I can assure you, if that is genuine, and only you can decide if it's genuine or not, something starts to shift down here. Something begins to move and begins to break up. That's where change takes place. So don't think just because you sit all day and you can't put 3 seconds together of concentrated meditation, I'm no good, I can't do this. I just don't buy it. I just think that's a delusion. That's complete rubbish. And because somebody can concentrate and go into the third jhana and then tell everybody how great they are that they can do this, I think that's just a trick. That's not wisdom. That's not real change. Of course, that's a lovely thing to be able to do, no doubt. It's not something I've ever been able to do. I've never wanted to do it. To think, well, wow, I can get in the third jhana, I've really changed, I'm really this and I'm really that, is not what Dharma's about. It is not about that. Dharma isn't about in your face. Look at me, I've changed, I'm not like this and I'm not like that. That's not Dharma. We can all do that in our ordinary lives. We can have a habit and we can break a habit. I used to smoke lots of cigarettes. And then I gave it up one day, quite easily actually. So I changed, didn't I? Big deal. That's not dharmic change. That was just some willpower, sort of a desire that I had. That's not dharmic change. Dharmic change doesn't work like that. It is incredibly subtle. We do change. We change far more than actually we are aware of. Because that which is trying to discover what the change is the very thing that's actually changing. So in other words, it's like what you're trying to do, when you're looking for change and you want something for your money, what you're actually doing is trying to lift yourself up off the ground. And that's not possible. So change is, I believe, and I think to me this is what the commitment is about, that commitment, and to put that commitment, to use another term that's called going for refuge. To go for refuge continually, to the best of your ability, and every time something comes along and knocks you away, to come back, to come back, to come back, to come back. And it's in that coming back, in that willingness, there's something there that begins to break up. And if you can go for days and weeks without good meditation, all this good and bad meditation, I'm sorry, I just don't buy it. But we all fall into it. My meditation was good because I was quiet for 10 minutes, or my meditation was bad because I wasn't quiet for 10 minutes. That's just, that's just up here, that's just playing around with things. The change comes when you are prepared. Like in this retreat now, we have a timetable. As an example, as a model, we've got a timetable clearly defined, nothing to think about, no choice, no options. Here is the timetable. I don't want to go. I feel this, I feel that. I'm fed up. Nothing's happening. I'm not going to go. I'm going to stop in bed. I'm going to go for a walk. That's giving in. What's important is to come here, is to get on your cushion, and even if you don't put 2 seconds concentration together, that actually doesn't matter anything. It doesn't matter anything. What's important is that you've committed yourself to come and to follow the schedule, to do the hours of meditation, and to come and to sit. That have far more effect on you than in achieving in your meditation. I firmly believe that. And we just get ourselves into this thing. You see, we end up creating values, good and bad, right and wrong, good meditation, bad meditation. It's bad meditation, therefore it's not working. It's good meditation, therefore it's working. We just buy into that deluded world that we've been caught by all of our lives, and we come to Buddhism and we bring that deluded world with us, and we pursue the deluded world and we feed that deluded world in exactly the same way as we did before we come to Buddhism and the practice. And this is what we've got to wean ourselves off from. We've got to have that, to cultivate that willingness and that ability to pick ourselves up and just do things because they're there, not because it has to be perfected in our imagination, but do it because it's there. And that just goes against the whole grain of this thing that's continually reinforcing itself over and over again. And have that willingness. Like I say, this retreat is a perfect example to truly practice the Dharma in its correct way, which is to just follow the form. Give yourselves no options, no values, no success and failure and all that sort of stuff, which we all fall into. There is something that is beyond that, that's going on, that's beyond that, that actually I don't think we ever really truly understand. But it's very subtle, and it takes place beyond the conscious mind. And actually, in truth, change is actually none of our business. It's got nothing to do with us. It is not mine. I'm changing, I'm going to do this, I'm going to change to this. True change actually takes place beyond all of that, and it's very, very subtle. It is so subtle that 90% of it we're actually not. We can be aware of a little bit, bits here and there, for sure, but 90% I would suggest that actually we're not aware of it. You know, you can take it as a... You know, if you take the whole of your personality, let's say, let's make it into a disc for a moment, and we've got these bits here and the bits there and a bit here and there. You know, nice bits, light bits, dark bits, da-di-da-di-da, all stuck together, and we create this sphere with all these different components. And of course, we're always picking and fiddling with these things. We're looking at the good bits and the bad bits, and I'm going to work on this, and I'm going to work on that, and I'm going to do this and do that. I'll tell you how the Dharma works. The Dharma is not in the slightest bit concerned with all your lights, the light bits and the dark bits, and the bit that you want to change and the bit that you don't want to change, and the priorities and the this and that and the ambitions and all the rest of it. It's, you know, that's your problem. The way the Dharma works, let's say that's you as a whole, is that it's a polishing process. It just goes like this, very, very gently, over the entirety of your personality. It doesn't pick the bad bits and leave the good bits behind, and the bits that you want to change. It doesn't concern itself. It's like a polishing process that goes over your entire being, if you like, and it just goes round and round, very gently. And it will go around gently, providing you've got the commitment. If you don't have the commitment, it stops and it finishes. If you've got that commitment, it's like this polishing process, very gently, that embraces the whole of you. Not the bits, but the whole of you. And that is so subtle. That is so... Because it's not so obvious and in your face. It's just that gentle, you know, like you could polish a stone, and you just polish it, and you can spend the whole of your life polishing a stone. And it may get brighter and brighter, but it brightens up so slowly that actually you're probably never aware of it if you polish it on a daily basis. That's how the Dharma works. It's very subtle, and it embraces the whole of you. And because it embraces the whole of you, it is very unlikely that you'll ever really pick it, that you'll really ever understand it. And that's actually brilliant. In one way, you think, oh, come on. You know, I want to see what I'm getting for my money and for my effort. But you imagine that if you really did see that, and you really did know that, how that would so easily become yet another possession. Look at me, I've changed, I'm this and I'm that. And how that would so easily become an ego trip, which it can often do. But rather, you know, leave all that alone. It's a great mystery, and it's an amazing mystery. You may get to see it one day, you may get to see how it works. But it really has nothing to do with you as a person. Your engagement, your part in that, your part, and it's the most crucial and the most important part, is your commitment, is your willingness to come back, whether it's good, whether it's bad, whether you sit quietly, whether you don't sit quietly, whether you're in pain or whether you're just emotionally fed up and physically fed up, mentally fed up, da-di-da-da-da, to come back, to come back, to come back, to come back. And when you willingly come back and sit with it, that polishing takes place. And I think, to me, if there's a secret here, that's the secret. I think it's just very subtle. And it's not, and it doesn't relate to how we like to think or how we would like it to work and how often we imagine it to work. I haven't got a decent practice because I can't concentrate. You know, I just think that's mitya ditti. You may be making a statement of fact that you're not concentrated, which is fair enough, that's a fact, that's okay, but you're not putting value on that. It's when we put value on it, good and bad, right and wrong, that we miss the point. The Dharma is not interested in all these bits and what you think is good and what you think. Who the hell do you think you are to say that, you know, what's good practice and what's bad practice, you know? This is something beyond our, you know, beyond our ignorance and delusion. And we have to learn to trust and surrender ourselves to that. Learn to trust the process. And because, you know, I can tell you that, I don't know, about 10 years ago, 15 years ago, I went for 1.5 years. I mean, this is all after all my experiences in Sri Lanka. I went for 1.5 years, every single day, literally 1.5 years, never mind a few hours or a few days, 1.5 years. I couldn't put 2 seconds of concentration together. 1.5 years. That's a long time, you know. When you sit every day, and you know, you can absolutely guarantee, I knew, look, I'm going to sit on that cushion, and I know, what an utter complete waste of time. Why don't I go and do something constructive, like watch television, or, you know, do something. It's not going to happen. But I knew by then that actually that was never the point. It's not the point about, you know, opening up and being at one with the universe. That's not the point. I knew that by then. If I hadn't have known that by then, there could have been a crisis. Without question, there would have been a crisis. But I knew that this is not what it's about. It isn't about it being the way that I want it to be or the way I think it should be. But I had the commitment to come there every day, and just sit there. And then get up and come back the next day and sit there and the next day. 1 year, 8 months that lasted. And I'm not exaggerating. And there was never a break in that 18 months. And then one day, it gave up. And then it cleared. And everything, all what I would like, what would be enjoyable, and of course, naturally, you know, the fruit and the loveliness of meditation, that all came back. But I'm sure, I am quite sure that if I never had that conviction that actually it isn't about achieving, it isn't about being this and that. It's the willingness, it's that willingness to come back to the practice is the absolute key to this. That, I had that conviction in place, and so that's what carried me through. That's what allowed me to carry on. And always, always holding on to the reality that everything is impermanent, and that sooner or later that this had to break. Mm. It would break, and that's absolutely what it did. And thankfully, I've not had to go through it again since, and you know, hopefully not again. But if it happens, then it happens. I mean, now I can sit there. I can sit on some days just like you. You know. Things are all over the place. They're not how you would like them to be. I mean, that happens to me. But I never, ever make a problem with it. I don't even think about it. I don't start saying, oh, God, what a waste of time. I'm not doing, what am I doing wrong? And what am I, and getting into all that reactivity over something that's actually perfectly natural, because we all ebb and flow. None of us go in a straight line. The human condition does not go in a straight line. It ebbs and flows. We're organic mammals, we're not robots. We do not go in straight lines. And it's to learn to get comfortable with the fact that we ebb and flow, and not to make a problem of it. That's so important. And to keep that commitment in place through all circumstances. And I know, you know, when I sit I don't have any expectations of what it would be like. And sometimes it's how I would like it to be, and sometimes it isn't. But I never get up and make a problem out of it. And that's what all of us should try and work towards. And just come back to your commitment. That's what you need to check. You don't need to check the quality of whatever, but just check are you willingly bringing yourself back over and over and over again? And if you do that, then you're practicing, I believe, the Eightfold Path, but you're certainly fulfilling going for refuge, because that's what I believe going for refuge is truly about, as a living commitment. So I don't know what the question was originally. But anyway, there you go. It's all on the CD.
Can the Dharma be corrupted? Or is it pure in its essence? Or is it us and corrupt? It
cannot possibly be corrupt because it's untouchable. It doesn't... You can go to it, but you can't take hold of it and corrupt it.
Well, I mean, putting, say, for example, Marxist-Leninist ideals onto the Dharma, or for Western ideas onto the Dharma, or, you know, however you want to see it.
But that's not the Dharma. The Dharma isn't a theory, isn't a system. The Dharma is the natural law of the universe, and that you can never possess that. I mean, you can hang labels on it and say it's this and that, and then corrupt the labels. That's got nothing to do with the Dharma. The Dharma is untouchable, thankfully. Nobody can touch it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's eternal, and it's exactly the same now as it was at the time of the Buddha. And it's in this very room, in this moment, in exactly the same way that it was for the Buddha. It's the natural law of which we actually live out of. And when we truly see ourselves in our true original state, we will see that beneath all of this nonsense, we are the Dharma. We are eternal. We are not caught in the world. We do not, in our true nature, we never go through this cycle of birth and death. And that's inconceivable, isn't it? But it's something that can be seen. Many, many have seen it. It can be seen to be the truth. And that's what we all hopefully are aspiring to.
What is the faith point when you fall over and you get up, you dust yourself off, you take one step forward and trip over the same stone again and keep on doing it? And like you say, there are no kind of obvious signs of change. You don't see it happen. There's nothing that you gain you can sort of put in your pocket at the end of the day.
Yep.
So why does the faith come out?
Well, that's why spiritual practice is only for the few. Because we don't get the rewards that you can get when you do things in the world that inspire people to soldier on. That's, you know, when it comes down to it, genuine, I don't necessarily mean people around Buddhists that necessarily got a true spiritual practice, but those that really do really pick it up in its true sense are few, because it doesn't work in those terms. And this is, to me, is a very essential, non-negotiable aspect of the spiritual path, is one of faith. Faith and trust. That what you've read, that what you've heard, you feel is right. This is right. It's something. It's more to do with the heart. It's more subjective than intellectual. I mean, if you are insisting that everything on the spiritual path be described to you intellectually, so that it intellectually means that it's got a logic, it's got a beginning, middle, and end, and when you get to the end, you know, it can be proved to work. If you're that type of mind, if you're that type of person, you can't do this. Because it doesn't work that way. It isn't something of the mind, it's something of the heart. And that conviction is something that you yourself have to nurture. Nobody can give it to you. Nobody can give you faith. Faith can be blind at the beginning. Because you're taking on words and ideas and what, you know, what people tell you and stuff, and okay, you know, you can have faith in that. But the great thing about faith is that if you test it, that those beliefs that you've originally taken on actually become something real. You actually know this. You actually know this as a fact. This actually works, even if it's only an inkling, not necessarily something very deep. And then that, you might call blind faith in the very beginning, actually goes beyond that and actually becomes something real for you, because you know that it works. And that faith then gives you inner strength. You know that it works, even if it's only provisional. It gives you that little bit of strength to be able to bear with. So when you fall over, you know, you've just got that conviction that it actually does work, and then you can pick yourself up. And slowly through that whole process of change and learning to bear with, that inner strength gets more and more, and allows you to bear with things more and more. And all that stuff that was faith, that was something that was out there, actually becomes your own living experience. And actually, in the end, you go beyond faith. In that sense. But if you don't have faith in the first place, I think you're really in trouble with this. Is the first obstacle you come to, there won't be anything there to hold you, to keep you going. This doesn't work, I'll go and do something else. Whereas if you do have that, cultivate that inner conviction, it will give you that strength to come back.
You've spoken of conviction, commitment, and almost that's the need to be able to, that's something we need to cultivate and develop, or it feels kind of contradictory.
To faith?
No, to sort of letting go.
Yeah, when we learn to bear with, I mean, this is another important characteristic of what we do. When we learn to bear, you know, we are dealing with emotions, as far as how we're talking here, learning to bear with that emotional habit, that emotional reaction. I mean, that's a wild strength that if we can learn to bear with, we'll actually revert back to it will lose that wildness, and it will revert back to its original state, which is actually a part of us, which is actually, that is our inner strength, that will give us inner strength. This is not just some sort of an abstract thing that takes place, oh, it's turned over and off we go. Actually, what that will do will actually become ours. We will become it. Otherwise, what's this Dharma about? It's only a theory. Unless we actually begin to live it and begin to get benefit from it, then, you know, what on earth is it all about? It's just an idea, isn't it? That ability to bear with the difficulties that we have and the habits that we're learning not to fall back into, that strength, when it loses its wildness, will actually become our own inner strength. And that's genuine strength. That's not a wild strength. That's not an ego thing, an aggressiveness. It's a quiet inner strength, and that's very important. And that's something that will then allow us to take us to the next situation that we have difficulty with. That bit of inner strength that's become us, that's become ours, will actually allow us to bear with the next difficult thing. And when that turns, that then becomes more strength, so that we end up with this inner strength that does allow us to bear with life. And we can learn to bear with it rather than become reactive towards it and hit out and do all the things that we've done in the past. Now we can just bear with it and stay with it. So the Dharma very much becomes us, or we become it. And unless that happens, what's it for? It's just ideas, isn't it? It's got to come into our life. It's got to have an effect in our life in a concrete way. Well, hopefully, you know, we've all got a bit of inner strength. We're not bereft of it. Otherwise, we wouldn't even be coming in here. We do have enough to get us going. But it's something that I'm sure, you know, you realise after years of practice that you do have more strength, emotional strength, that you had in the past. You have that ability to stay with. Well, I'm talking about myself, I suppose. I mean, things that I would so easily be reactive towards 30 years ago or whatever, gosh, you know, that's just not there anymore. I mean, that strength is there, that all of that energy and all of that wildness has turned into an inner strength. And that's very crucial, and that's very real. I mean, that is concrete. That is really concrete. I mean, not literally concrete, but it's but in terms of the human condition and our life. I mean, that is something tremendous to have inner strength, as we all know. The more we've got, the more life becomes more bearable and more manageable. So that's, I mean, that's a very good point, and it's something that's often not talked about. But it is, you know, if you want a fruit from this practice, it may not be the fruit that you want, because you want to see, nirvana or whatever. But actually, what it will give you is inner strength, and that will be genuine and a human strength, not a wild strength, a truly human strength.
Just to clarify this, because I think that can be easily understood. So you say that insight arises also, you know, not looking for it from within. But where is place for reflection?
On?
In this way of meditating.
Oh yes, there is. I think it's important to lay the foundation and to put the structure in place, and that's something that we need to learn. And it's like learning to walk before we can run. I think it's utterly crucial. We all want insight. We all want the great wisdoms that come out of all of this, but we're not prepared to put the framework. We're not prepared to work at putting the structure in place. We all want to leap into that and leave this behind. Like I've said, that, you know, our, for example, our posture is very important, and it's important that we do create a cradle that can support us and support our involvement with ourselves and with life. And this includes the insight process also, which actually will naturally arise to some extent. It can then be guided. It usually is guided in some way, but it can only work if it's done in the proper framework, what I like to call the dharmic environment. And until we get the dharmic environment in place, I think it's not a skillful thing to do to leap, sort of jump over that and go into all the really good stuff that we want. We don't want the framework, we want all the good stuff, all the insight and the stuff that comes out of that. But I think if we try to leap ourselves into that before we're ready, before that's in place, we get ourselves into trouble. And lots of people do get themselves into trouble, physically and emotionally, because they're leaping into something that they're not prepared for. They're leaping into something that they don't know how to support, because that whole insightful process is not just wonderful light and great stuff. It can bring up big demons as well. It can bring up a lot of stuff once you start to go down that insightful path. And that's part of it, and that demon would eventually, you know, become the Buddha. But in the meantime, it's a demon. And if you're not prepared, if you don't know how to support that demon, you're going to be in trouble. And lots of people do get in trouble. And I've met lots of people who get in trouble and have got into trouble. And why? Because they don't have a framework. Some great gust of wind comes along, and because they're not grounded, they're not rooted, they're not structured. That is immense power. And we carry immense power within us. And that power can be very dark as well as be very wonderful and light. But we got to be prepared to be able to bear with those difficult winds, as it were, that dark side, those demons. And if we're not prepared, we're going to be in trouble. And I personally do not want to be responsible for people who get themselves in trouble, who come and see me. I am not going to go down that road. I'm not going to promise people things and get them all up in the clouds and chasing all of this stuff when they're not prepared for it. Because I think this position carries terrific responsibility, and I don't want to be responsible for people who end up with a lot of mental difficulties. And the reason why that is because they haven't learned to walk before they start to run. But there is a whole insightful path, which is truly wonderful, which I'm quite happy to go to share with people, especially individuals, when I would consider them to be ready for that. This is the most wonderful thing any human being can aspire to, in my estimation. But also it carries a lot of dangers, and I'm very aware of the dangers. And I've come pretty close myself to being a victim of those dangers. But I was very, very, very fortunate that my early years were nothing other than putting that framework, putting that structure in place, which is what I learned for the first few years. The whole insightful thing was, well, there was some there, but it was pretty superficial, I suppose. But what I did learn is I learned how to put that framework in place. And when I went away and I was on my own, when all the forces of the universe, headed by Mara, came charging at me, I knew how to work with it. I knew how to work with those forces, even though it still took me to the edge. I knew how to work, and I came through it, and I'm not damaged by it at all. And that's why I believe that anyone who takes this path up, which is the most wonderful thing anyone can do, it's got to be done skillfully. And we've got to be very patient. And we've got to put the right roots down and the right framework down, so when the winds blow, we can support ourselves so that we don't get carried away into realms that we may never even come out again of. And so that whole insightful thing, it will, you know, the very fact that we sit quietly and turn ourselves into ourselves like that, we get to learn lots about ourselves anyway. You actually don't have to mention that, because we do begin to understand ourselves, begin to see, and the great fascination of trying to unpick this thing called me sort of takes hold. And we understand a lot more about ourselves than maybe we give credit to ourselves for. And that's the dawning, that's the path, that's the wisdom aspect of the path, which is actually in play. But you know, I feel as though myself that I'd rather put the framework down for people first and get them, well, I can't put it down, but encourage people to do that. And then that other stuff will follow as and when. That's my attitude. Other people like to dive in on day one and tell you all about all this stuff. And I just think, well, that's for them to decide. But nevertheless, if we don't specifically go down an insightful sort of thing, the insight is there. It's, you know, you can open up to it. You can begin to get inklings. You can begin to feel and to see and to know. There's something very interesting. There's something very wonderful that's going on here. And you naturally, your curiosity will take you around. And you poke and you probe. And that's natural, and that's what you're doing. I've done it from day one. You can't help it. You sit down and you're quiet and you start to investigate, even though you're not meant to investigate. You don't have to be told to investigate. That's why I never say it, because I know damn well that's what everybody does. You know, but what you do is encourage people to really gather themselves up. Because if you don't do that, and you get seduced by this whole insightful thing, you will go running off quite, you know, it's like we just go running after things because it's really good, it's interesting and it's great. We go running off and we leave. We don't have that centre, we don't have that foundation. And the insightful thing is the most wonderful thing. That there can't be anything in the world that compares to it. But there's always the other side, there's always there. It's like two sides of one coin. We look at one side of the coin, we don't realise there's another side. And if that flips over and you're not prepared for it, you're going to get in trouble. And that's what we have to be very careful of. Anyway, we've seriously run over for change. So that will do for today. Thank you.